Welcome to the CXO Society Show, part of the Change Society podcast. My name's Matt Bradley. I'm a partner at Sullivan & Stanley, better known as S&S, and we are a change and transformation partner challenging traditional management consultancy. The CXO Society is a peer platform for executive change leaders to discuss the future of work. We host a range of community events and roundtables that focus on improving organisations and the executive journey. Today in the booth, I'm joined by Simon Hamblin. Simon is a successful CXO and entrepreneur. He's had a really interesting journey over the last 20 years working for some big names in the industry like ASOS and Emirates Group, while also founding his own company, which was in the blockchain and in cryptocurrency space. So really looking forward to the chat today. We're going to cover retail, we're going to cover ASOS in those early days, entrepreneurship, cryptocurrency, blockchain, innovation and leadership. So lots to get into and lots of interesting insights from someone that's been at the forefront of some very exciting things. Hope you enjoy the show. So welcome, Simon, to the show.
Thank you.
Very humble to have Simon Hamblin here. He's had a very interesting career, packed a lot into 20 years. He's been a successful CXO for some well-known brands and also been a successful entrepreneur as well. So I think all our listeners will be very interested to hear about your journey. So I think it's always good to maybe start in the middle, Simon, or maybe not quite in the middle, but start with a time in your career where everything was zen and everything was in flow and you were loving life and everything was great. So what was that kind of moment in your career?
I think that's got to be the time that I was at ASOS.com. So I joined there when there was only two other people in technology. There was only 45 people in the company. Share price was about 50 pence. It's such an early stage to join ASOS, and we didn't know what it was. So we didn't know what it was going to be, more like. When I left the company 8 years later, we had about 250 people in IT, and there was 1,200 odd people in the company. Share price was about £18, and since then it's been up to what, £70, down to about £40 today. But it was just the culture. It was the belief about what we were doing and how everyone was aligned. And I think a lot of that came, well, definitely a lot of that came from Nick Robertson, the CEO at the time. And Nick's vision was about getting us to 1 billion turnover over 5 years in five markets. And that's all you needed to know. You didn't need to know anything else. There was no other questions for why you came to work or why are we doing this? Why, you know, what are we doing? Where are we going? It was always, it's on the wall. It's written down in front of you. Everybody knew it was 1 billion, 5 years, you know, five markets. So everything you did, every meeting you had was, well, why is that relevant to 1 billion, 5, 5? You know, well, the 155. And then, you know, it was either relevant or it wasn't. It would get chucked out or you carry on. Yeah. But it was early stage. And, you know, for me, it was about building that legacy of which, you know, they still run on some of my systems today. Which is surprising, but you know, I'm just really proud about what we were, you know, I've achieved at, you know, during that time.
Cool. No, I mean, it must have been an exciting journey to be on. So, is that kind of what key was to what made it a success? Do you think just that having that clear vision and linking any activity back to that?
Definitely the clear vision. Everybody that came in knew, you know, why they came to work and what the purpose was. But also because we just innovated all the time. There wasn't the barriers, there wasn't the red tape, there wasn't the governance. And you almost didn't need that, because as long as you were working against that ultimate vision, you didn't need all of that. Mm. And that just allowed us to pivot. We could bring new solutions in, new technologies in. We grew the team really quickly. We had some real great talent, you know, in the team. And I think that's just what allowed us to get to where we got to so quickly, which was ultimately the most visited fashion website in the world, which is incredible. Also, at the time, we're taking it from you know, we take mobile for granted nowadays, mobile websites, but that was when, that was sort of early days of mobile, and then there's a big initiative to push it into, you know, make the website mobile compatible. And then in addition to that, obviously we're going into 5 markets, so that's outside the UK, and then internationalizing the site, translating the site. And a lot of that's taken for granted today, but we were really, you know, pushing boundaries back then, as well as scale, right? Yeah. The amount of traffic that we were, you know, handling.
And were you in a, you, I guess it was one of those companies as well that may have, you were in, you had that kind of moment in time where customer behaviours were changing slightly as well, and you're able to exploit that through innovation.
Well, definitely. I'd say the most innovative, I remember the meeting very well, the most innovative stage for me, from a business perspective at ASOS, and as you say, related to customers. I mean, this is early stage e-commerce, don't forget. This is back in, you know, between, you know, 2002 to 2012, you know, such. I remember the meeting, which was, Nick was saying, we're going to offer our customers free returns. And everybody looked around the table and went, okay, but 40%, I mean, that's a retail average, right? So it's not surprising. 40% return rate. Can we sustain that financially? You know, because there's a cost to every return, whether it's, you know, through the carrier and processing that return back into stock. And Nick just said, we're going to make that happen. We're going to be the first in the industry to offer international free returns. And that was it. Nobody could then keep up because nobody had, you know, the supply chain that we had, or the level of investment that we had to keep up with that. And that really propelled us, you know, to meet the customer demands, because that's what customers wanted, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer now, but at the time.
At the time. Although
I have recently read, interestingly, I think ASOS has blacklisted some serial returners, people who just buy the clothes and then wear it on Instagram, the Instagram influencers, and then send it back. So they blacklisted some people because it's left a big revenue hole, but no, it's really cool. And so what's your view on retail generally now, just quickly then? I guess it's an industry that's under a lot of pressure. I think, you know, the most recent ones in the news now are Mothercare, or Boots, Selfridges as well. So, you know, I think, yeah, obviously everyone's talking about brand loyalty, and is brand loyalty dead? And it's about what customers are interested about, what companies do for them today, not yesterday. So, I mean, what's your view on just retail at the moment, and kind of how do you win? You know, what's gonna help you know, companies stay the course?
I think everybody knows it's really tough for retail at the moment, but it's been tough for a while, and you know, people have talked about the death of the high street, but that hasn't come about. But retailers just need to keep innovating and listening to their customers, in my view. I think that retail in the high street as such will become more experiential. Mm. So if we take an example of a Debenhams store, a Debenhams store is a good bit of, you know, retail in the high street. It's a good location, most likely, and it's going to have a good structure to it. But it's just typical retail, which is why it's always going to struggle. But actually, what I think it'll become is more a kind of a touch and feel as you go through the store. It'll be a touch and feel. You'll order it. It'll appear at home for you while you go through to the next floor up, which will be where you might go and dine before you go to the next floor up, which you then go and, I don't know, watch a movie or experience a show or something like that. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It just becomes a lot more experiential.
Yeah.
I went to Kew Gardens recently. Okay, it's not retail, but just an example. I went to Kew Gardens recently and they had a pop-up car show there, right? You know, everyone's trying to think differently about how to, you know, bring the customers in. Yeah. From an online perspective, I think it's about predictive, so more curated, predicted content that's really aligned to you. And we talk about personalization. That's probably an older term. It's a bit traditional. But now, you know, we really want to understand when you visit a site, for example, we know already that you're going on holiday. So you don't need to come and look for shorts. And I always give kind of the typical fashion examples, but it's easier for me. But you don't come to the site and look for shorts. We show you that because we already know that you're going on holiday. And so we you know, we curate that content because we know so much more about you.
Yeah.
So I think it's that curated, you know, predictive content.
Make it as easy as possible to press buy, basically.
Yeah, as frictionless as possible.
Yeah, and I agree on the customer experience point. I think I think Urban Outfitters are trying to tap into the sharing economy. That looked quite innovative. They're launching like a subscription service where people can go and get six pieces of clothes and rent them for a month and then take them back. I think it's that type of thinking that will...
We see a lot of that, right? There's so many of those business models popping up on the subscription side of things. It's not going to dominate, but again, it's just showing how the market innovates, to meet the customer's demands.
Cool. So take me back, Simon. I'm keen to obviously get into a little bit more around your entrepreneurial journey, but it'd be good to just know a little bit more about Simon growing up and where the interest in technology came from and why you chose a career in it, basically.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sometimes I wonder how I've got here sometimes, but I always think back and I think I was quite entrepreneurial at school. And I found, so first of all, I found school very difficult. My parents worked tirelessly for me to have a really good education. I just think I was a massive disappointment to them for the whole duration of it, if I'm really honest. I never excelled at school. I didn't know why I was there, if I'm honest. I really didn't know why I was there. I didn't understand the point of it. And I never applied myself at school as much as they wanted me to. But I was the one in the playground, for example, as a young child, selling toast. Right, I saw the need, so I thought I set up a toast.
I wish someone stole toast in my playground.
And was selling toast and had a queue around the playground because everybody wanted to buy a piece of toast. So then we moved on to
toast to your customers there.
Exactly.
Everyone wants toast in the morning.
Then we moved on to aluminium skateboards. There's a bit of a story around that, but that's when the old flick boards came out, and then we made them out of aluminium, and we used to customize them and made to order. And then I had various car wash enterprises in the holidays and all sorts, but I always did things like that. And then I ended up, we always had a computer at home. We were lucky enough to have one of those. We had for those that are listening and remember what a 286 is, and then a 386 and a 486. We had a 286 laptop, which was bigger than most desktops nowadays. But we always had a computer at home, and I didn't realize, again, the impact that they would have. And then when I went to university, I had to choose a course. And I chose geography and computing. Geography because I had an interest in it. It was just one of the things I actually found quite easy, and I was interested in it. And computing, I thought, hold on, I can't do geography for the whole 3 years. That'll bore me. So what else do I know and I like? And someone said, oh, you can do computing. So I did computing. I ended up then majoring in computing and getting a first in my degree because I found something that I was so passionate about. Yeah. And I think that's a really important lesson for me. And also I apply that lesson to my kids as well, is I don't think the future for people is around academic. Obviously there are certain industries where that applies. But for most people, in my view, it's just about collaboration, being able to work with other people and being able to find that thing that you're really passionate about. And if you find that thing you're passionate about, it, from my own experience, is that you'll excel at it.
Yeah.
And then that's what I've done. I just got into technology and I love it and take an interest in it, and I've always applied myself in it.
Yeah, no, it's good advice. Cool, and I guess that may be where it's interesting to hear about your school days, actually, and selling stuff on the playground. So it's where these entrepreneurial kind of light bulbs came from. Because as I said, you've got a really interesting journey. So obviously took a role with ASOS, moved through the ranks there to CTO level, and then you set up your own company, which is just not a move not many people would make at that stage. Once you've got to that level. So I mean, was that just kind of something like burning inside you, or did you see a gap in the market? Can you just take me through your thought process at that moment in time?
So luckily I'd set the company up on someone else's dime. That made it easier. But it was just at that stage in my life, I wanted to do something different. I've always enjoyed those early ASOS days and that entrepreneurial side of the business. And I realized I wanted to get, and obviously I've got those tendencies as well. And I wanted to get back into something, along those lines. But I was working for a wealth management company at the time. Again, it was just right for my situation in life, and it was those shareholders that had a belief in Bitcoin at the time. And as obviously being part of that board, I saw the opportunity, and I just wanted to be at the forefront. And I said, "Well, listen, guys, I want to set up that business. As a separate, has to be a completely separate standalone business. I want to set that up from start to finish." if you'll fund some of it, I'll go and fund, you know, I'll go and get funding for the rest of it. Mm. And that's really where it came from. But it was about itching that itch, if you like.
Yeah. And can you just kind of briefly explain for our listeners about what Natageo was? What was the business model?
Yeah, Natageo was a Bitcoin exchange, but it was a three-way Bitcoin exchange with precious metals. So it was the first one and only one ever in the world that's been had that precious metals component. As I said, the wealth management company was all around storing and selling precious metals. So mm-hmm. it all kind of made sense. But you could essentially use British pounds, fiat currency, to buy Bitcoin or buy precious metals. You could go from gold into Bitcoin, Bitcoin into gold, and not even touch the financial system. And so you had this kind of, you know, three-way. We ended up being a successful exchange within the UK, but the market in the UK, I think at the time it was something like 0.25% of all Bitcoins in the world were bought and sold in the UK. So that's a tiny market,
yeah.
Right? And then there's four or five other exchanges operating in the UK as well. So it's an extremely difficult market to operate in. Coupled with the fact that you cannot get a bank account as a Bitcoin-based business in the UK. So I'm not joking. I can provide proof of this. I have done over 100 banking applications in a year. I was traveling all over the world, Hong Kong, Middle East, everywhere, to try and get a bank account. And I ended up getting a bank account in Botswana in the end, which then I ended up being one of those people that sort of saying to you, as a UK customer, could you send your funds, please, down to a bank account in Botswana? It was just really difficult. But yeah. I actually managed to run the company off for a whole year before I got that bank account. I ran the whole, you know, a whole company without a bank account, which is, trust me, there are ways of doing it, but it's really hard. So I'm paying staff and paying suppliers without a bank account. Really tough.
Yeah, and it's a journey. I mean, I've been on the journey here with SNS for the last 3 years as we've been growing the company, and I mean, it's been, you know, as exciting a time as any in my life, but with the most amount of highs and lows as well. And sometimes you get the high and then you don't realize the biggest low is literally around the corner. So
yeah,
what was your hardest part of becoming an entrepreneur and moving into that? What do you remember being the most difficult, and what advice can you give to people on that?
I think you've really touched on it, actually. Ultimately, it's failure. That's the hardest part. You know, a lot of what you do won't work,
yeah.
You know, either in the journey itself, and so you've got huge lows, but there is some stuff when you get stuff right and you get stuff moving, you get stuff delivered, or you get a piece of press or something, you know, you get massive highs from that. So you've got huge highs, but there are huge lows. And so you have to stay motivated. Now, I've always typically been sort of a solopreneur, I think the term is, so operating on my own, which is extremely difficult. I'm saying it's harder, it's just extremely difficult because I don't have somebody there to share that with, and, you know, somebody to rally me. I have to do that myself, right? So I think if you're co-founding, you know, with two or three others, I think that is a much better mix, because you keep each other going, you can brainstorm a lot more, you can share the load, you know, and I just think it's perhaps more achievable if you're starting on that entrepreneurial journey, is to go into something with somebody else that's got a different skill set to you. You don't want an overlapping skill set.
Yep.
But doing it with somebody else, I think, will definitely help.
And was that your biggest learning from the journey, with hindsight? Is that, would you try to co-found the business if you did it again now?
I could do it both ways. I think the biggest learnings for me are just how hard it is, how involved it is, how full on it is.
Yeah.
How much you invest your whole self into this thing to make sure, because you know, you haven't got anything else to fall back on. So you've got to make this work. You've got to do everything and anything to make it work. And that's hugely exciting for me anyway. But again, it comes with all that risk of failure. The other one is about getting a product out the door, getting the MVP out. I've got many examples, you know, even now, friends or colleagues where they're working on their new thing. And I go, okay, well, right, how long have you been working on it for? Oh, about a year and a half.
Yeah.
Have you launched it? Have you got it out there? No, because we need to do this, and this. And you go, come on, you've got to get it out there. You've got to get the minimum out there. You've got to get the feedback. You've got to iterate. You've got to understand what the customers want. And ultimately, you're probably going to end up pivoting. Mm. And you've got to be willing to pivot, you know, looking for that pivot point, because you thought it was this, but actually it was that. Mm. So getting that product out there is really key.
And does that link in a little bit? I'm kind of interested for our listeners just to understand your, if you've got any advice really for people going into a capital raise. So I know that was, you know, obviously an important part of the business model to start with. So if you, obviously getting some product out the door is important to that, to show, show the capital people what's going on. But any other advice for people going into a capital raise?
Two things probably. One is the time it takes. And that again is why, you know, entering into the entrepreneurship side with somebody else is actually really key, because it's going to take you away from the core focus of that business. So if all your time is consumed raising capital, you're going to take your eye off the ball of actually launching a product and doing the other piece. So it is full on, it is time consuming, it is a circuit. You're just over and over and over selling and selling and selling until you can raise that capital, and that's almost a full-time role. So you've just got to be conscious of that and how you're actually going to manage that. And then the other one is probably choosing the investors. It's all very well just trying to get that money and saying, yeah, okay, I've raised X, but what type of investor do you want? Is it an angel investor? You just want that sitting in the background, you know, seed investment? Is it actually a full-on VC that wants oversight? And actually, how involved are they going to be with you on the day-to-day journey? Are they going to be quite hands-off? Are they going to have a lot more say in your business? And so it's understanding the investor and also the value that they're going to bring or you want from that investor, right? It's not just go and raise some money. It is a little bit, there's a little bit more to it than that.
That's it. I think you need to, it's a bit Dragon Den style, isn't it? You want to see what else they're going to be bringing to the table.
It is totally that. It is, okay, you're investing in me, but you know, come on, Deborah or Peter, what are you going to bring to the table?
So, have you got a network and have you got an address book? So cool. So I think obviously a really interesting business, and again, one of those moment in time pieces, a little bit like ASOS in a way, and obviously cryptocurrency is still a really hot topic. I think Bitcoin's just hit a 10-month high, and kind of put your finger in the air. But I mean, for someone who's been at the forefront of it, what's your prediction for cryptocurrencies? I've heard Facebook are planning to launch one in a couple of years, and I don't know. From personally, it still feels a way away from being really scalable, but I'm keen to get your view on it, really.
I get asked this question quite a lot. you know, the first thing I always say to people is only put in what you can afford to lose. Right? We just prefix the conversation with that. And this is not investment advice. Ultimately, the number of Bitcoin transactions, you know, over since it started is, you know, on the rise, whether it's from institutional investment or just general usage of Bitcoins or other cryptocurrencies. There is a huge altcoin market. I'm not really sure what the value of those really are, you know, apart from kind of a whimsical, perhaps, well, not whimsical, it's a bit strong, but, you know, a trading perspective. You've got Ripple that could dominate because of the smart contract functionality.
Yeah.
So I think that's got additional functionality in addition to the actual currency itself. Regulation has always been a topic of interest, even when I was in it. You know, we were talking about regulating and which countries might regulate it, and do you regulate it, right? And regulation is there to protect the customer, ultimately. That's why regulation exists. But when you, so there's definitely an argument to do that because it's so volatile, you know, in itself, that you should regulate it. But if you regulate it, then you're adding credibility to it, right? So you're in the, I think the regulators are always playing this halfway house. Do we regulate it? Don't we regulate it? Because we're damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Yeah.
So will regulation come? Ultimately, it will. Because if the price keeps rising of these, you know, cryptocurrencies, and, you know, customers are, you know, it's affecting more and more people, then that's where regulation gets involved. In my opinion, that's how it works. So ultimately, it might become regulated, which will then push it to that next level. I've always said though, a cryptocurrency is a payment method of choice. It's never going to dominate. I always used to get asked, "Oh, is it going to replace the pound in the UK?" Yeah. No, it's not going to do that. I always took people to a coffee shop in Shoreditch.
Sure, yeah, right. Yeah. The famous coffee shop.
Yeah, and I always used to take people there, and I used to go. A lot of press, and they say, "Okay, what's this Bitcoin thing about?" And I say, "Right, here's a £5 note," and I put it into a Bitcoin ATM, and I hold up my phone, and I get Bitcoins on the phone, and they were like, "Is that it?" "Yeah, that's it. That's how quick it is." "Okay, well, do you want a coffee and a piece of cake?" "Yeah, okay, fine. We'll just pay with Bitcoins that we just put onto the phone." You know, and we show them this thing, and you say, "Look, I could have paid for that with a debit card or a credit card or a PayPal or." You know, as I said, cryptocurrency or cash, even, yeah. You know, lo and behold. So for me, it's a payment method of choice. And will we see more of that? Probably, you know, as it continues to take hold and transactions rise. But ultimately, the value for me in cryptocurrencies, where I am at, is the actual technology underneath it. Yeah. It's the blockchain side that really, for me personally, provides that value.
Yeah, because I was wanting to move on to that really, is the technology that underpins it. And again, another really hot topic at the moment, or has been for the last couple of years really, is blockchain. I think people are still getting an understanding of it, and it's quite synonymous with banking, obviously, and payments. But there's a lot of other industries now that are looking at utilizing it as well and some of the benefits of it and hopefully it can do some good in the world. So what industries do you see blockchain making a big impact on?
Well, I start off with, there's probably three areas that blockchain can really benefit, or three types of processes or businesses. So a business with a disconnected process with lots of third parties involved, right? That's where blockchain is going to strive. Or where you've got geographically dispersed suppliers and customers, so that cross-border nature, again, blockchain applies there. Or situations where integrity is essential to it, you know, where you've got the complete transparency, you know, of transactions, you know, and what they might involve. So from an industry perspective, there's a few examples. So maybe banking is I have to start with that one, because obviously cryptocurrency is where... Ultimately, well, one would argue they were ultimately created in order to, you know, disrupt the banking industry. You know, banking is essentially a lot of legacy systems. Yeah. It's a closed environment. It's very difficult to get into. You know, one would argue it's open to manipulation. You know, one would speculate that. and it's, you know, it's an anti-competitive environment. But blockchain ultimately makes it, you know, that gives it that transparency, that instantaneousness around transactions, and also makes access to payments, you know, to millions more people that don't have access to bank accounts, for example.
Yeah.
But probably more interesting examples might be in publishing. So publishing ultimately is controlled by a small group of publishers. So for you to as a publisher yourself, it's difficult to get recognised because you're at the mercy of the publishing industry. So an example of a company that's been built on blockchain in the publishing side is Authorship. And that basically allows you as a publisher to publish your own thing. You own a stake in what you're publishing. It's all done through tokens. And, you know, your success is dictated basically by the public market. Mm. And that's going to be based on, you know, the quality and the demand of what it is that you're putting out there. Healthcare is another one. It's a difficult industry to modernize. It's very large scale.
Yeah.
It's got lots of old processes, legacy, again, data as well is an issue within healthcare, and outdated infrastructure. Ultimately, the real use case there, I think, is around patient confidentiality, that secure storage, access to that storage. And again, another example is a company called Patientree. When Patientree raised $7 million in just 3 days off their ICO, and they obviously targeting patients, providers, healthcare organizations, and they're all about that secure storage and access to data. Mm. But you as a patient, this is what I love, you as a patient can decide who has access to your health information and all that history. You're in control of that. Not somebody else.
Yeah.
And you can decide who can see how much of that You know, you say you're in control of that, and it's centralized. Mm. You see what I mean? And anybody, you allow access to the third parties as you need to. So yeah. I really like that. And lastly, probably a slight left field one, but I think it's interesting nonetheless, is fishing industry. So obviously it's a vital part of any, you know, any yeah. economy, the fishing. But with growing restrictions, regulations and environment, you know, sustainability, it's under the limelight. So an example there is the WWF, so the World Wildlife Fund. They partnered with, I'm going to say this right, Consensus and Sequest Fiji, two organisations where they can verify that the fish that they purchase is not as a result of illegal fishing. And they also track the fish through the supply chain where it was caught through to the distributor. And it just gives that complete transparency and ownership.
Yeah.
And I just think that's quite, I know it's a left field example, but I think it just shows that blockchain has so many use cases. And I don't think we've really understood them all yet, but people are really trying to, you know, apply this type of technology to solve these challenges.
I think we can see it in a number of industries. And as I said, I think it can certainly do more good than harm. And I think voting is another industry it's looking to do. And the publishing piece, music, the music industry, which is similar as well. So giving that transparency and it's almost creating a bit of a fairer society, really, isn't it?
One thing I would say, though, is we need to stop using the old conversation. Oh, we'll build that on blockchain. We'll do a startup and base it on blockchain.
Yeah.
Blockchain has a use case. Yeah. Right, and it's not everything's going to move to blockchain. It's the same with not everything's going to be moved to Bitcoin. It has a use case. We need to understand what that use case is and apply the right technologies.
Yeah.
But I've often come into conversations about, well, can we just build it in blockchain? Well, why? Why would that benefit? You know, just because you want to use blockchain, it's the new fancy thing.
It seems to get a capital raise.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's just linking it onto what you're doing now. I think air travel is another. Industry, I've seen a little bit of news about maybe utilizing blockchain and kind of smart ticketing and different things, which is just kind of bringing us up to date with where you are now, because recently you've moved back into the transformation space.
Yes.
Doing a big transformation in Emirates Group. So I think it'd be good to just finish on for the last 5 or 10 minutes, just to kind of get your view on, you know, transformation and leadership and executives, really. So it's always a hot topic, and it's always something I have a lot of conversations around working with SNS and execs as well. So it may sound like a simple question and an obvious question, but I'm always interested in everyone's answer because it's always slightly different. But why are larger enterprises struggling with innovation and transformation?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you probably get a similar answer from most people, but I still think it comes back to processes. Legacy processes that are just holding people back. And I've worked out that from working in small organizations to working in large organizations, the more people you bring into an organization, the more sense of the fact they need a piece of ownership. And they get that piece of ownership through putting in another process. And no one is actually looking across all those processes from start to finish just to see how hard it is to navigate from A to B.
Yeah.
And as that, it's like a tree, like a downwards tree, if you like, it just grows and grows and grows. And that just slows you down more and more and more, because there's more red tape, more people to convince, more governance, you know, more gates, whatever you want to call them. It's just harder to get stuff done, which then just slows down innovation. There's more at stake, right? So I get that. Larger organizations, there's more at stake. So they need a higher degree of control, a bit more governance, but it can't be at the expense of allowing, you know, people to innovate. You've also got the silos that get built up, right? In small organizations, you don't have silos. Like, you know, we were talking earlier, you guys are, 25, 30 people, you can talk. There's no real silos. You just talk across the room. That's quite easy. You know, large organizations have full-on departments, and you get that ownership again, that process, and we do this and we do that. And therefore, it's difficult to innovate across them. But and also, I don't think that people are necessarily challenging people to innovate. I think we talk about innovate, but no one's actually challenging to innovate and really breaking down those boundaries or those processes and getting to the bottom of that. But I think it is a top down, it has to be top down that message, sorry, has to be top down. It can't just, you know, percolate, you know, if you like, within the
teams. No, I totally agree. Because I think I've sort of mentioned it a few times, but a lot of companies talk about technology innovation, they talk about capability innovation, but they don't talk enough about management innovation and, as you say, breaking down silos and, you know, 19th century management principles, yeah, etc. And yeah, it's fundamentally, it's about good leadership, really. You know, the amount of organisations I go and meet where they're just really lacking in good leadership. So, and you sit on a number of boards and work with a number of executives. So, I mean, what's the... I guess, yeah, it would be good to see both sides of the coin, really. What's the most effective board you've sat on, and what's the least effective board you've sat on?
The least effective boards are the ones that just cascade information, just socialise information between themselves. They use that board time just to talk through what they could have spoken about outside that room, or just said, can you read that in advance? It would have been good enough. The most effective boards, from my perspective, my experience, are the ones that actually get into a debate about an important topic, not some of the lower level topics that I also find that come up to a board level, such as, you know, how much should that policy, you know, what should that policy be? It's not what a board should be debating. No. It should be, you know, where are we going strategically in this particular area, whatever it is. And then debate it and make a decision on it and then cascade that. So I think the ineffective ones are the ones that are just socializing information, and the effective ones are the ones that are debating the real topics that are going to change that organization or keep that organization at the forefront. And a board that also is not afraid to challenge each other on in a constructive way. Mm. I've been in a situation before, two situations. One is on the back, on the quieter side, where people are just talking, people acknowledge, and then that's it. That's the board. It's not really a board. And then you've got situations where I've been leading a change, for example, and I've actually, the non-exec has actually had to get up, right, which is interesting in itself that someone's got out their seat to actually then go over to a whiteboard and facilitate the conversation around the whole table, because there's so much debate, right? And in a really good way, not a heated debate, a constructive debate. But actually, that non-exec got us from A to B. And I think that was a really interesting example. That's when the penny dropped in my mind about what a really good proactive board, you know, looks like.
Yeah. I think that having a non-exec direct there, and something we have at SNS is an advisory board as well, right, where we get three people to come in once a month to stress test what we're doing and kind of hold us accountable, because I think it's difficult when you're a CIO or a CEO. You don't necessarily have anyone to report to. So I think having...
You need that external challenge. And as I said, in a constructive way, a sense check, a challenge. Yeah. You know, have you thought about this, or why have you done that? Mm. You know, and just be able to ask those questions and also provide that support.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So we're kind of coming towards the end. Two questions, I think, will be good to finish on. So I think we talked about effective boards and different things. And as I said, you've packed a lot into your 20 years. You probably, I don't know when you want to retire, but you've probably got another 20 years. Who's had the, interesting, going back to personal, but who's had the most effect on your career so far? Who's given you the most advice or given you the most... knowledge to work with?
Well, that's a difficult one. I've worked with so many amazing people, and
give a shout out to someone.
No, because that's singling some people out. No, I have. I've worked with some really great people. I've learned a lot. Yeah, a lot from people. I still come back to, I suppose, at a more macro level. There's two people. One is when I was younger.
Yeah.
As I said, I always struggled at school, and it was the bit where my coach, so sports coach, who we did a lot of sports training, so I was very close to him and the team, and he said, you shouldn't compare yourself to other people. You need to compare yourself to yourself. And I always remember that. That was when I stopped trying to be something else, and I actually tried to be myself, and that started to really work.
Yeah.
So that was one that always sticks with me. I can even see that right now. That's an image in my head that will never leave.
It's an important mindset shift, isn't it? Yeah.
And that just, well, I don't know what it was. It was, I was 17 and 16, 17, and it was just that moment, and that really had a big effect. And then I switched, just coming back, you know, it was ASOS, it was Nick Robertson, it was him having that vision and just driving that vision all day long. And I haven't been, you know, fair to say, I haven't been in another organization with such a clear vision and direction. And I think that really kind of shows, actually, from within the experience I've had within those organizations, without that, you know, that vision, that leadership, it's much harder. Mm. So yeah, those two.
Cool. Cool. Final question then. It's a good one to end on, because it's always quite broad. And again, you hear similar answers, but you always get a couple of new things come out. So what's exciting you about the future, and what do you see as the future of work, and kind of just generally, what's the business and technology landscape going to look like in 5 years' time?
Yeah, I'm probably going to, as you say, give a fairly predictable answer. It's obviously going to involve the likes of AI and machine learning. I think we're like early internet days, late 90s in those technologies in a way. You know, everyone knows that there's something in it, but we don't quite know how it's going to impact us yet. But yeah, definitely around the artificial intelligence and machine learning side, voice is going to become more, obviously, so much more prominent. Everything we're doing is more voice driven, whether it's at home or at work.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, I recently found out my son's dyslexic, and he's only eight, and now he's allowed to take his Surface to school, and he can just it's not about him writing stuff down. Actually, that's not important. What's important is that he knows the knowledge, and he's just all about voice. And I think that's an interesting shift, that even at school, you don't need to write. Obviously, you can write the basics, that's fine, but that's not the emphasis.
No.
So voice is there. And I actually had a thought the other day, I mean, this is interesting for somebody, which is, what's the workplace going to look like when we're all using voice? Because we created an open plan workplace for collaboration. And I'm thinking about your workspace, you know, right now, because we've just been in it. It's an open plan workspace. We're absolutely right? Because you need that for collaboration. But we all, trust me, we don't want to be typing stuff. We just want to be, using dictation to get things down. So how does that work in an open plan space? Because I don't want people listening in to everything that I'm writing. I haven't quite worked that one out. So maybe the workplace will change around voice. That could be interesting.
These open plan spaces, and then lots of pods. Probably.
That's what I'm thinking. I think you're going to build all these, you know, little telephone booths where everyone's going to be standing on their own, just talking.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't want other people to listen. So there's something there that's going to change. But also convenience from a business perspective. I really still believe, coming back to my entrepreneurship sort of side of my head, is that anybody that comes up with a business model that saves people time, right? You're essentially selling time, which comes back to yours, like your subscription models and things. Mm. Those are going to win over other things. Now, I just heard the other day, if you look at Uber Eats and... it's gone from my head. Who's the other one?
Deliveroo,
thank you. If you look at those models, they're obviously really taking off, and Just Eat's getting into there as well. Mm. I've also heard that in Toronto, they're building flats without kitchens, because people just are going to rely on the convenience side of delivering food, which is insane.
Yeah.
That's like going completely off the scale.
I know.
But anything around that convenience from a business perspective, convenience, but I think it will circle back round to experiential, because I think people will get fed up with that and actually want to have a more tactile, experiential experience.
I totally agree. It's that experience. It's customer experience is the ultimate battleground for transformation, I think, at the moment. And I think obviously the technology companies are like Apple and Amazon, who've got so much customer data, are obviously leading the race, and it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds over the next 5 years. So cool. Well, look, Simon, I really enjoyed our chat, and we've gone over quite a bit there in 40 minutes. So some really interesting insights, some good pieces of advice, and it's been a pleasure hearing about your journey so far. So thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you for inviting me.
Hi everyone, hope you enjoyed the show. If you're interested in hearing more about the CXO Society, connecting executives globally, then please visit our website, thecxosociety.com, and register your interest, and I will be in touch.